We have one TV in our house, and for all intents and purposes, it's an old TV. Okay, I'll tell you exactly how old. We purchased that TV on February 4th, 2017, so it's more than 8 years old right now. And by the way, before you think something else, this is not me using the pulpit to promote Megan, we need a new TV agenda at all. This is not what's happening right here. I do have my eyes on those Samsung like frame TVs, the ones that like when the TV isn't showing, like you can have like pictures, they look super cool. Anyway, neither here nor there. I was remembering when we got that TV this week, kind of like connected to this topic. I know the exact date because it was the Saturday before Super Bowl 51. When we thought goodness was winning and the Patriots were gonna lose, they were down 28-3. And then somehow the wicked continued to prosper and they came back and won that Super Bowl. Okay? Now, at that time, we were living in D.C. We had moved to D.C. to start a church. The church hadn't started yet, but we were trying to build relationships, make friendships. And we thought, hey, why don't we invite people to our house that we've met in the neighborhood, invite them over to watch the Super Bowl with us. It was great. Plan ahead. The whole thing. And that week, I think it was the enemy, the TV started glitching. And, like, you know, the remote wasn't working. It was turning on and off on me, the whole thing. Saturday morning before the Super Bowl, I tried turning the TV. It's not working. I looked at my wife, and I say, Megan, we need a new TV. Like, what are we doing here? We have people coming over. This TV is old. It doesn't work right. It's for the kingdom. We should get a new TV. So Megan rolled her eyes at me, but she acquiesced, went in the car, went to Costco, and got these nice, like, Samsung 4K things that, At that time, it was like fancy and brand new, and it was a sale, so it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. So we set that up. Super Bowl happened. It was great. And then I started trying to figure out, hey, what's wrong with this TV? Can we fix it? Can we, like, put on buy nothing or whatever? And I plug it in, and it turned on. And then I started fiddling with the remote. The remote isn't working. And so what would happen if I change the batteries of the remote? And I changed the batteries to the remote. And the TV functioned fine. I'm telling you, I don't know why it never occurred to me to do that Saturday morning. I mean, I have a couple of ideas, right? One is I need a new TV. Number two is that the TV had been glitching, so there was a little bit of confirmation bias that there's something clearly wrong with this TV. And C, well, I kind of wanted a new TV. So I wasn't too preoccupied doing that. Now, the reason I'm telling you this is because I was thinking this week on that, you know, the remote of my TV was fine. It just didn't have the proper access to power. And because it didn't have the proper access to power, I thought that there was something wrong with the TV. When things are not connected to the right power source, they don't work the way they're supposed to work. Sometimes they don't work at all. I actually believe that church is like that. You see, being a part of a church is this incredible experience that varies so much from person to person. From some people, church is transformative and life-giving. For some people, church is painful and traumatic. Sometimes that's happened to the same person in the same church, or across a couple of different iterations of church communities they've been a part of. Have you ever wondered why that is? Think about how the writers of the New Testament talk about church. The Apostle Peter, for example, says this in 1 Peter 2:9. He says, "For you are chosen people. You are royal priests, a holy nation, God's very own possession." Or how about how the Apostle Paul talks about the church in the book of Ephesians? "So now you Gentiles are no longer strangers and foreigners. You are citizens. Along with all of God's holy people, you are members of God's family. Together we are his house, built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, and the cornerstone is Christ Jesus himself. We're carefully joined together in him, becoming a holy temple for the Lord. Through him, you Gentiles are also being made part of this dwelling where God lives by his Spirit." This is an incredibly high, lofty language that the writers of the New Testament used to talk about being a part of this thing that we call church. Now, maybe it's just me, but I read passages like this, and I take a look at what in our current society we consider church, which is an event that lasts about an hour where you walk into a room in the dark, you sing some songs, and then listen to someone speak. If it's Chad, it's for a few minutes. If it's me, it's for a little bit more minutes than that. And then we go home, right? And I've used this metaphor before, but I think that today the best descriptor for what people think church to be today is not any of the passages we just read. It's just a concert and a TED Talk. Like, that's kind of like what we think when we think about church. And honestly, that's not to say that that isn't important. I believe in the importance and the power of this gathering. But in the Bible, church is a group of people, not a meeting. For so many people, their understanding of what being a part of a church means is to attend a one-hour service on Sunday mornings. But when you look at the New Testament, the church was a community that did life together and served Jesus together and cared for one another. Could it be that the reason so many people are disillusioned by church, the reason why so many of the descriptors that we read in the New Testament of what the church is supposed to be like sounds so dissonant to us, is because we are not fully plugged in to all that the church is, so that we can actually experience the power of what the church is supposed to be like. So what I want to do over the next 3 weeks is take a look at how the writers of the New Testament describe the church and what it ought to be along these three distinctives: doing life together, serving Jesus together, and caring for one another. And I'll be upfront about our intentions. We have an ulterior motive for doing this. We want to invite you to plug in and get involved participating in those three dynamics. Not only because we believe that the church as a whole is going to benefit from your involvement, but because we sincerely believe that you benefit from getting involved. Because while we are far from perfect, and I would argue that no church is perfect, and while we could do those three things better, and our hope, my hope, Chad's hope, is to continue getting better at those three things, by plugging into the life of our church beyond just attending on Sunday mornings, you are going to experience more and more of the power of God at work in the church. And God's going to use that to transform you into a person that looks and acts more like Jesus. So today, we're going to look at that first distinctive, doing life together. What does that mean, and how do we do that here at The Journey? One child during the announcement section, he mentioned the starting point class. That's something that I teach once a month. And you know, it's kind of like an introduction to The Journey, what we're about. And during this class, one of the things I do is I take people through the three main elements of what I would call our church strategy, or kind of like our operative system of what we do. And it's these three things: encounter Jesus, experience community, and engage the mission. Everything that we do as a church falls under one of these three elements. For us, this is how we carry out our mission as a church. This is how we believe we're going to be able to accomplish the vision that we think God has for us as a church. And one of those elements, as you can see, is experiencing community. We want everybody who calls The Journey their church family to find community here. In other words, if you want to plug into the life of our church, part of what that means is to experience community. But what do we mean by community? Actually, a better question, I think, is what are the writers of the New Testament referring to when they talk about the church as a community? How did the people at the time when the church got started think about the idea of community in the first place? And the best reference point that we have is the initial description of the church in the book of Acts. So let me take you to this story. This is happening. Jesus has just ascended into heaven, and Jesus tells the band of followers that remain, he says, I want you to go and pray and seek my presence, and something is going to happen. And the thing that happens is that the Spirit of God manifests in this incredible way. Everybody starts kind of like speaking different languages. Peter, who was not known for being like the sharpest tool in the shed, gets up and preaches this incredible message. 3,000 people become Christians, get baptized, and we're off to the races. This is how the church starts. And kind of like towards the end of that like incredible description of the beginning of the church, this is how the writer of the book of Acts closes that section. He says this, and all the believers met together in one place and shared everything they had. They sold their property and possessions and shared the money with those in need. They worshiped together at the temple each day, met in homes for the Lord's Supper, and shared their meals with great joy and generosity, all the while praising God and enjoying the goodwill of all the people. And each day, the Lord added to their fellowship those who were being saved. This passage always makes me chuckle when I read it. Because at least to me, it doesn't sound like too appealing of a form of community. Like, at its best, it's kind of like a 70s hippie commune. At its worst, if we're honest, kind of sounds like a cult. Like, let's put that in today's terms, right? Like, imagine that you're coming in today, and it's your first time at the Journey, and you walk in, and I say to you, hey, you know, here at the Journey, we share everything in common. So there's a sign-up sheet here. Can you put in your login credentials for your bank account? And also, we share our possessions, so there's some people that are having needs. So if you have a second car or a second home, we have like a guy that works at a dealership and a realtor, and they're going to help you get rid of that so we can take the money and distribute it. By the way, we have a worship service every day, so we would like to, you know, see you tomorrow again. Oh, and we get together to share a meal at home. So tomorrow, we're all coming over for dinner to your house, right? Before I finish saying that, you've either like stoning me or walking out the door. Okay? It sounds incredibly bizarre. But believe it or not, for the people in the first century, it kind of made sense. And I've always struggled with this until I read this book. It's called When the Church Was a Family by Joseph Hellerman. Joseph Hellerman, he was a pastor. He's a professor at Biola. And he does kind of like this combination of sociological study and historical study of how people understood community in the first century. And in this book, he makes two main observations. The first one is this. First century Jewish culture was what sociologists would call a strong group society, or what we would call today a collectivist society, except that collectivist sounds communist, so we don't say that word, right? Meaning that in those societies, the main filter for decision-making, it's not what's best for me. The most important thing in a strong group society is what's best for the group. How a person thinks about their identity and their vocation and their place to live. You know, every aspect of your life is kind of seen through the lens of what's good for your community, which is usually your family. The second thing that he observes is that at that time, particularly in Jewish culture, the understanding of family was much wider than us. When I say family, you're probably thinking specifically about your nuclear family, right? Like your spouse, if you have children, your children. Maybe you have a pet and you consider your pet part of your family. It's okay if it's a dog. It's weird if it's a cat. You know, like whatever you think, like your immediate closest, you know, section of your family. In the first century, there was this patrilineal understanding of family. Patrilineal means that your main understanding of who belonged to your family was anybody that shared in the bloodline of your paternal ancestors. So your family is not only your children, your family is also your siblings and cousins and, you know, aunts and uncles and grandparents. It's like this larger sense, anybody that kind of like sharing that bloodline, you are considering part of your family. Now, based on those two observations, he looks at what the writers of the New Testament, from, you know, the gospel writers to Paul, what Jesus says, what the apostle says about the church. And the conclusion that he arrives is that In the New Testament, one of the dominant metaphors that we find to talk about the church is that of a family. That Jesus would say things like, hey, you know, my mother and my siblings is not Mary and my blood siblings, is anybody that does what my father says, right? That the Apostle Paul would write to the people at the churches and would use language as brothers or sisters. One of the verses that we read earlier says that we are the family of God. Hellerman's conclusion is that he doesn't think that that's actually a metaphor. He thinks that they actually believe that. Not only in the spiritual sense, right? Like the spiritually we're all brothers and sisters, but in the first century, becoming a Christian meant that you were kind of like transferring your primary sense of belonging and identity and also familial obligations from your patrilineal bloodline family to the family of Christ. As the church expands to the Roman Empire, this keeps happening. So, for example, Romans 16 is kind of like towards the end of the book of Romans. It's kind of like the greetings and says this, Timothy, my fellow worker, sends you his greetings, as do Lucius, Jason, and Sosipater, my fellow Jews. I, Tertius, the one writing this letter for Paul, send my greetings too, as one of the Lord's followers. Gaius says hello to you. He's my host and also serves as host to the whole church. Orestes, the city treasurer, sends you his greetings, and so does our brother Quartus. What Bible scholars think is going on is that as the letter is being dictated, the guy writing the letter, Tertius, taking dictation from Paul, he's going around the table and looking at everybody that's in there and says, hey, they send you their greetings. They send you their greetings. Now, being at somebody's table in the first century is an incredibly intimate act. You don't just invite people to your table. And the way he's talking about it, that Gaius is our host and that the church meets here, what Bible scholars think is happening is that all these people kind of like, almost like live together. Like even if they don't like sleep there all the time, they can come into the house whenever they want and they can sit at the table whenever they want. There is this large unit that kind of like consider themselves of part of the same household that has been created by being a part of the church. Now, when you understand that way of thinking in the first century, a passage like the one that we just read in the book of Acts starts making some sense. Because if I think about it, if my family has a need, of course I'm going to do everything I can to help. If there was like this, you know, terrible financial crisis, somebody's going through this big medical emergency, if we need to sell something, if we need to get a loan, we will do it, right? You might think like that as well. By the way, there's parts of the world that this still is how people live. Like in Ecuador, where I'm from, it's changing a little bit, but kind of the custom is you leave your house when you get married. So on my mom's side of the family, she has several siblings, a bunch of them, like four or five, they still live together. They're like in the 70s and 80s because they never got married. And they just pull in their resources and, you know, share meals together. It's kind of like a weird boarding house. But that's how they live. Right? It's kind of like normal in other parts of the world. This is important for us to understand because it's only in this context that the descriptors and the commandments for community in the Bible make any sense. For example, the New Testament is full of these interpersonal relationship commandments that we've come to know as the one another's. All these verses where the church is commanded to love one another. You know, I teach this class called Group Leadership 101 for people that are interested in leading a group or hosting a group. And I open the class the same way. I just walk people through a few of the one another's that we see in the Bible. Be at peace with one another. Wash one another's feet. Love one another. That's not a typo I forgot to replace. He says love one another twice in the same verse. In the next verse, he says love one another again. Couple of chapters later, he says, love one another, on and on and on. There's about 47 of these one another commandments in the New Testament. When the writers of the New Testament are talking about community, this is what they're talking about. Not just a group of people you know in passing who all attend the same concert and TED Talk on a Sunday morning. So much of the vision for what it means to be a Christian in the Bible takes place in the context of community. And it's really, really, really hard to do that. I would argue it's impossible to do that for an hour on a Sunday morning. Which leads me to two considerations. One is that I would argue that it is impossible for this to happen by accident. That this type of community requires intentionality. Why? There's a number of factors, the one I just mentioned too. The first one is this, the context of where we live. 2025 in Northern Virginia is set completely against any sort of margin of space, of finances, of time and relational bandwidth for this community to even happen, let alone thrive. But number two is that the primary way that people understood relationships, this strong group society were kind of like, you know, the needs of the group come ahead of your own needs. Like I think always of Mr. Spock, you know, like the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, but like the point is, right? Like that understanding of humanity, we're not like that. I would argue we're like the complete opposite of that. There's a sociologist named Robert Bala, and he coined the term radical individualism to describe how we function. And what he's saying by that is that actually our order of priorities and our decision-making matrix, what's good for me, what benefits me, what's comfortable for me, what advances my interest, is at the top of how I make any sort of decisions and how I view the world. And you may say that sounds like very selfish, but the reality is that it's subconscious for us at this point. We've all been habituated and indoctrinated into that way of thinking and being. And I don't say that to make you feel bad. I say that to open your eyes to the reality that everything, from the world that we live in to how we think and perceive, you know, relationships, is set against the biblical vision for community. So what do, right? Do we all buy a plot of land and start a commune somewhere in like the Shenandoah or something? That sounds kind of nice. Okay. Do we move in together with another family and start some weird like experiment? I don't know. I would argue that for most of us, that's just not realistic. The last thing I want to do today is kind of like saying, hey, you're not living in community, but by the way, life is so hard in Northern Virginia that you can't live in community. God bless you, right? That's not my purpose. I actually think that this is where a lot of rupture happens when it comes to most of the commandments of Jesus. That the Bible presents us this incredible vision for what life could be and should be, and I would argue eventually will be. And it's so different from where we're at that we just give up and don't even try it. Joseph Hellerman, the guy that writes the book on community I was mentioning, he says this. He says, our relational reality falls far short of our positional reality, where the horizontal aspect of the Christian life is concerned. Indeed, given the present state of some of our churches, recapturing Jesus' vision for authentic Christian community may seem like a nearly insurmountable change. What I want to propose to you this is, what if we actually could take some small steps towards that, even if it sounds so foreign to us? Those are a couple of things. Number one is this. We may not live in a strong group society. Our understanding of family is kind of like primarily the nuclear family. I would argue that even in our current reality, we have a way of understanding or imagining this sense of extended community beyond our nuclear family. You may laugh about it, okay? But if you've ever watched that show, they're kind of like a community. They're an extended family. Like some of them are related, some of them are dating. They live across from each other. And I will say this, okay? There's a lot of sinning going on in that show. I'm not excusing that. But a lot of the one another's that you read in the New Testament, they actually happen in the show. They bear one another's burdens. They care for one another. They forgive one another. Like, we, even in our, like, art, we long for that type of community. The type of community that you see in Friends is what sociologists call fictive kinship groups. An effective kinship group is like a community that is involved in your life that you are seeing on a regular basis that goes beyond your blood ties. It may be a family member. It may be a friend from college. It may be your neighbor from across the street. And you kind of like start forming like a circle of people that you know, are connected. Some of you have experienced this. I've shared this before when, you know, May and I started dating. We were part of this young adults group at our church. And it's this weird thing that happened that we all ended up living in the same apartment complex development thing. I had a roommate and we lived in a condo. Megan had another friend. They rented a house. There was another couple that lived in apartments. And all like we could all walk to each other's houses. And what ended up happening is that we started experiencing a level of community that went beyond just like a regular group meeting. Megan would open her house, you know, on Saturday mornings. And we would come over and we would eat waffles and play Mario Kart on Nintendo 64. And it was great. It was this incredible vision of me. But then also, you know, like one of the people in our group got diagnosed with cancer. And we threw her these like, we had to pray for her. And I said, why don't you come on a Friday night and we'll kind of like try to get everybody together. And everybody showed up and more people showed up. And we spent the whole night just praying for her and worshiping and enjoying each other's company. And, you know, we walk with her through that cancer. We've experienced, so maybe some of you have experienced this type of community, and it's beautiful. I would say that may be kind of like an initial metaphor for the type of community that God wants for us to have. I would also say, though, that there's another element in this, that it's not only about doing life together, it's about following Jesus together. That there is an element of affective kinship group that's not just organized about the idea that we like each other and maybe our kids are the same age and they can play together. But there's a level of intentionality that we believe living out the way of Jesus is something that happens together. So there's an element of studying the teachings of Jesus, of vulnerability, of sharing our stories, of confessing our sins, of encouraging one another, of being accountable to one another. The type of community the Bible talks about is intentional and is organized around the goal of following Jesus. And here is where I think that we can help you. Because at The Journey, we don't think that our Sunday gatherings are the only expression of the life of our church. We think it is an important expression, but for all the reasons I just listed, it's just not enough. As a matter of fact, we believe that a lot of the important action doesn't happen here during this hour. It actually happens in the context of community. Two main things that happen in community. Community is the main setting in which we experience God's love. Because God, most of the time, tends to love people through people. And that happens in relationship. But number two, is that community is the main setting in which we are transformed by God's love. That the purpose of the relationships that we develop in these fictive kinship groups are not just for companionship, are for transformation. That there is something that happens when I'm starting living with people where two things happen. One is like the rough edges of my personality and my sin get exposed because we tend to sometimes hurt people and say the wrong things and do the wrong things. And at the same time that the opportunities for us to forgive people that do that to us, also, like all these things happen in community. And if we're able to listen to Jesus and yield to Jesus, that in those moments, God begins very slowly to change us and shape us into people of love who act like Jesus. John Mark Comer from Practicing the Way says it this way, spiritual formation occurs primarily in the context of community. The place where we learn how to act like Jesus, how to love like Jesus is in community because love is all about interacting with other people. And for us, the way in which that community happens is through our groups. At Journey, we have different types of groups. And no group is perfect. I don't think I've spent the last 2 years researching how every church does group. They all have pros and cons, and, you know, there's no perfect solution. The way we do them here is that we have, like, three different categories of groups that we think can help people connect. Our main thing is something that we call neighborhood groups. Our neighborhood groups are organized mostly geographic. The idea of these groups is that we want you to find community with people that you will run into at your grocery store or people that would be in the same PTA board that you are, right? So these groups are not limited by age. They're not limited by gender. It's basically if you live in the same area, you're all welcome together. These groups meet during two semesters in the year. And the main thing that they do is they get together, develop community. And the discussion part of this is that they dig deeper into what we talk about on Sunday mornings. We also have now a type of group that we call study groups. And study groups are spaces where people can pursue specific things that they want to dig into a little bit deeper. Maybe it's a Bible study. Maybe it is a book club, different things like that. We have a group here, Journey, called Journey Women. And they do a lot of, you know, different events to connect. But then they have book clubs and things like that where they're connecting and digging deeper. We have a group of guys that meet, you know, on every other Thursday morning at Chick-fil-A. And if I'm going to wake up early, it better be for Chick-fil-A or Jesus, and that combines both. It's a great opportunity. You know, there's a group that we have, one of my favorite groups, called Bible Nerds. And they get together, and they're going through the Bible project, kind of like learning how to read and understand the Bible. We also have another category that we call social groups. And the idea of social groups are groups that are primarily designed to help you connect with other people and maybe develop those relationships. So they're organized about different type of interests. We have a group called Reserve that's all about going out to eat. And if that's not a taste of the kingdom of heaven, I don't know what it is, right? We have a group for singles of all different ages and stages that get together. We have a group called Journey Outdoors that like to do things outside. I hope that it's not right now when it's so hot and humid, but maybe it's like later in the year when it's nicer. But, you know, that's another group that you connect. We have something called Momco. Used to be called Mothers of Preschoolers. It's this community for mothers of, you know, of kids with all different ages that can come together. These groups are not the be-all, end-all of community. They're not perfect. No group is. But I would argue that you're more likely to experience Christian community in a group than outside of a group. So if you're here and you're not in a group, my challenge to you is join a group. Groups, you know, sign-ups open today, and groups are going to launch on the week of September 7th. So you have a little bit of time right after the message. I'm going to be outside in the tent. And any questions that you have of groups, come talk to me. I would love to help you find a community. One thing I want to close with is this. In the middle of studying for this, I came across a few statistics. A couple years ago, this study came out that said that Washington, D.C. is the loneliest city in the U.S. Alexandria sits at 8th place. 54% of Americans say that no one knows him well. 36% of Americans say that they experience frequent feelings of loneliness. 51% of young mothers feel loneliness frequently. 61% of young adults feel lonely. We are isolating ourselves more and more and more. And the result of that is that we're also becoming increasingly polarized and divided along lines of culture and politics and preference of any and every sort. We are lonelier and angrier at each other than we've ever been before. And I wonder if the vision for community that Jesus presents us with might be just what the world needs right now. Over the last year here at The Journey, I've officiated 2 funerals, which is more funerals than I've ever done in my life. And I actually get to share both of these stories throughout this series. One of the funerals was for a woman named Denise Thomas. Denise was a part of our community for several years. She suffered this tragic accident overseas. You know, it took her a month to be able to come back here, but she lost complete mobility of her body. And eventually, out of complications from that accident, she ended up passing away. And this went on for several months. And for several months, I got to check in on her a few times. And one of the things that I found interesting is that when I was checking in on her, the 2 groups of people that I would normally see her were her family and then her church family. The people that she had met at groups here at The Journey. I continued to check in on her and seeing how she was doing. She ended up in a hospital where somebody that used to be part of a life group with her also worked, and he kind of like created a group chat to let us know how she was doing and checking in on her. I remember one afternoon going to visit her with this person, and we don't even know if she could understand us or notice what was going on, but we sat in this room, and my friend, he pulled out his iPhone and played a Lauren Daigle song for her because that was her favorite Christian artist. And for me, that was like one of the holiest moments of my year. Because what that said to me was that this person suffering this terrible tragedy hadn't been abandoned by God. And she hadn't been abandoned by God because she had us. That's the power of community. And what I want to do now is invite you into what for early Christians was like the ultimate community-making, community-creating event. Which is a table. On the night when Jesus was betrayed, he took bread. And after giving thanks, he broke it and he said, "This is my body broken for you. Let's take the bread together." In the same way, after taking the bread, he took the cup. And after giving thanks, he said, "This cup is a new covenant in my blood poured out for you for the forgiveness of sins." Take the cup.